son?
She saw something in his face then, an anguish he could not hide. She had never known him to be so weak, so pathetically unguarded. She sneered. Kneel, Anomander, son of darkness! Kneel before this hostage! When he lowered himself to one knee, a sudden laugh burst from her. Disbelief, shock, delight. I proclaim my beloved son, Knight of Darkness. You I cast out. You're kneeling. Now. And she leaned forward. Grovel. Release Celana, Highness, or there can be no Knight of Darkness. Why not? Because you're destroying Carcanus. She stabbed a finger at him. As you did, when you made Mother Dark turn away. But don't you see? I can save you from all that. I can do it first. She bared her teeth at him. Now, who is the hostage? He rose then, and she shrank back in the throne. She had gone too far. She could see it in his eyes, his trembling hands. He seemed to be struggling to speak. Just tell me, Sandalath whispered. The truth. Where is my son? It was as if the question delivered a mortal wound, and Amanda Rake staggered to one side like a broken man. Shaking his head, he sank down, one hand groping for the edge of the dais. And she knew then she had won.
Back 10 paces.
In the space left by their retreat from the breach, bodies made a floor of trampled, bloody flesh, shattered spears, broken swords. Here and there, limbs moved, hands reaching, feet kicking, legs twitching. Mouths in smeared faces opened like holes into the abyss, eyes staring out from places of horror, pain, or fading resignation. Charles, who had failed in keeping her brothers alive, and who had thus far failed in joining them, stood beside Captain Brevity. She held a sword, the point dug into a corpse under her feet, and knew she would not be able to lift it, not again. There was nothing left, nothing but raging agony in her joints, her muscles, her spine. Thirst clawed at her throat, and every desperate breath she drew deep into her lungs was foul with the stench of the dead and the dying.
Stiffen up, lads and lasses, growled Brevity. They're suspicious, is my guess. Not sure. But count on this. They're coming.
Someone moved past them then, burly, heavy in armor. Sergeant Sellows, the last of the prince's own soldiers. He made his way to position himself on Yedan Derig's left, drawing round and setting his shield, readying the heavy-bladed sword in his other hand. For some reason, his arrival, so solemn, so solitary, chilled Charles to the core. She looked to her left and saw Yan Tovis, standing, watching, a queen covered in blood. And how much of it belonged to her own subjects? But no, the question no longer mattered, nor the fact that she had led them to this end.
We all end somewhere, she whispered.
Brevity heard and glanced over, spat blood, and then said,
That's the truth of it, all right. The only truth there is.
Charles nodded, and somehow raised once more the sword in her hand.
I am ready, Captain.
We all are, soldier.
Behind them, Charles heard a low murmuring. The words, we all end somewhere, rippling out, taking hold, and soldiers slowly straightened, drawing up their weapons. When the words followed the curve of waiting soldiers and at last reached Yan Tovis, Charles saw her flinch as if struck, and she turned to look upon her people, saw them straightening, readying, saw the look on their battle-aged faces. Their queen stepped back then into the gap, one stride and then another. And all at once all eyes were upon her. Lightfall streamed down behind her. It could have been a thing of beauty and wonder. It could have been something other than a manifestation of terror and grief. But it was as if it ceased to exist for Yan Tovis as she scanned the faces, as she fixed her eyes upon the last 1,000 subjects of her realm. And then, with even her brother looking on, the queen knelt, not to the first shore, not to this horror, but to her people. In the swirling wound 8 paces behind her, a row of spear points lashed out, scything empty air. And then, pushing through the miasma, fully armored soldiers.
Shit,
muttered Brevity.
That's heavy infantry.
Jan Tovis rose, swung to face her ancient foe. For a moment she seemed deaf to her soldiers, shouting for her to rejoin the line. For a moment, Charl thought she might instead advance to meet them, and she saw the flank behind bristling up as if to rush to join her. One last suicidal rush, to die beside their queen, and oh, how Charl longed to join them. Then Jan Tovis turned her back on the enemy, rejoined her soldiers. The first row of Leosans stepped clear of the wound, another following. They were shouting something, those Leosan, shouting in triumph a single word, but Charl could not make it out. Yedan Derig's voice rang out above their cries.
All lines! Advance 5!
And there, 4 rows back of the Leosan front rank, a knot of officers, a single figure among them waving his sword, as if to cut down his own people, and they pressed back on all sides. And there, off to the right, another widening swirl of humanity, making space, and there, upon the left, the same. Charl stared, unable to understand what they were. The 3 isolated warriors then dissolved into blinding white light. And the light burgeoned, and inside that light, massive scaled shapes taking form. The flash of blazing eyes, wings snapping out like galley sails. And the dragon at the center then rose into the air.
We all end somewhere. We all end here.
As the center ranks rose up to collide with the Leosan front line, Yedan Derig, with Sergeant Sellos at his side, pushed forward. 5 lines between him and that veering dragon, his only obstacle. But these were the elites, heavily armored, perfectly disciplined. He saw the other 2 soul taken, 1 on each side, but there was nothing he could do about them, not yet. The Hust sword howled as he slammed into the front line. The blade was gorged on draconic blood. It had drunk deep the red wine of hound's blood. It had bathed in the life ends of 1,000 Leosan soldiers. Now it shook off the chains of constraint. So swiftly did it slash that Yedan almost lost his grip. He grunted to see the soldier before him cut through, shield, sword, chain, flesh and bone, diagonally down his torso, gore exploding out to the sides. A backswing split open the chests of the man to either side. Like a cestus, Yedan and the soldiers closest to him drove into the Leosan ranks. The Hust sword spun, lashed out in blurs, blood sprayed. Yedan was tugged after it, stumbling, at times almost lifted from his feet as the weapon shrieked its glee, slaughtering all that dared stand before it. All at once, there was no one between him and the soul taken. The wreaths of white fire were pouring off the shining scales, the solid bulk of the dragon rising to fill Yedan Derig's vision.
Shit, miscalculated. It's going to get clear. Sister, I'm sorry, I'm too late.
The head lunged. He leapt. The sword sank deep into the dragon's chest. The creature roared in shock and pain, and then the wings hammered at its sides, scattering Leosan and Shake alike. And the soul taken lifted into the air. Hanging from his sword, Yedan scrambled, fought his way onto the dragon's shoulders. He tore his weapon free, cut 2-handed into its neck. 20 reaches above the melee, the creature pitched, canted hard, and slammed into Lightfall. The concussion thundered. Yedan Derig slid down over the dragon's right shoulder, down between it and Lightfall. The dragon's neck bowed, and the jaws plunged down to engulf him. As they closed, the Hust sword burst from the top of the dragon's snout. Wings smashing the wall of light, the giant reptile reared its head back, Yedan tumbling free, still gripping the sword. He was caught by the talons of the Soul-Taken's left foot, the massive claws convulsively clenching. Blood sprayed from the body it held. Again the dragon careered into Lightfall, and this time a wing collapsed under the impact. Twisting, pitching head first, the creature slid downward, slammed into the ground. Yet Anderig was thrown clear, his body a shattered mess, and where he fell, he did not move. At his side, the Hust sword howled its rage. The journey through the forest by Rake's last three soul-taken, Korlat, Prazek Ghul, and Dathenar Phandoris, had been as savage as fighting a riptide. Silana was among the most ancient of all living Elaint. Her will tore at them, drove them to their knees again and again. Silana called upon them, called them by name, sought her own summoning. Still, they managed to resist, but Korlat knew that to shift into draconic form would simply make it worse, the blood of the Elaint awakening in each of them, chaos unfurling in their souls like the deadliest flower. At the same time, she knew that there were soul taken at the first shore. She could feel them. And what could the Sheik do against such creatures?
Only die.
The Leosan soul taken would be able to resist Silana, at least for a time. Or perhaps indeed they could even defy her, if their own storm, when it broke upon this world, was strong enough, and she feared it would be.
This is not the taste of one or two soul taken. No, gods, how many are there?
Korlat!
Gasped Dathenar.
I know, but we have no choice, do we?
Prazek spat behind her and said,
Better to die in Karkarnas than anywhere else.
Korlat agreed. As they reached the rise, they saw a frenzied battle at the wound in Lightfall, and the Leosan soldiers now pouring from that breach vastly outnumbered the defenders. They saw a man do battle with a dragon rising skyward, saw two Leosan warriors veering to join their winged kin. They did not hesitate. Darkness bloomed, erupted like black smoke underwater, and three black dragons rose above the strand. As they closed, eight more Leosan veered, and the air filled with the roars of dragons. Yan Tovis dragged herself over corpses, trying to reach her brother's horrifyingly motionless form. The two witches were taking the last from her. She felt each sorcerous wave they lashed into the flanking dragons, heard the soul taken screaming in pain and outrage, and knew that all of it was not enough. But they were stealing from her this one last act, this journey of love and grief, and the unfairness of that howled in her heart. Soldiers fought around her, sought to protect their fallen queen. Bodies fell to either side. It seemed that the Leosan were now everywhere. The Sheik and Lethary lines had buckled, companies driven apart, hacked at from all sides. And still he seemed 1,000 leagues away. Draconic sorcery detonated. The bed of bodies beneath her lifted as one, and then fell back with a sound like a drum. And Yan Tovis felt a sudden absence.
Squish. She's dead.
A trickle of strength returned to her, and she resumed pulling herself along. Her bones were rattling to some distant sound, or was it inside her?
Yes, inside, yet still distant, as far away as hope, and that is a shore I will never reach.
It shook through her, shook even the corpses beneath her, and those to the sides. Two stood to either side of her, two of her own, the last two. Fighting. She did not have to look to know who they were. The love filling all the empty spaces inside her now could take them in, like flavors. Brevity, who imagined that her friend Pithy was still with her, still fighting for the dignity they had always wanted, the dignity they'd once thought they could cheat and steal their way to find. Charles, sweet, young, ancient Charles, who knew nothing of fighting, who knew only that she had failed to save her brothers. And would not fail again. There were all kinds of love, and, with wonder, she realized that she now knew them all. Before her, 5 simple paces away, could she walk, lay the body of her brother. Another concussion.
Holy, I am sorry. There is no glory in dying young, unless you were old first.
No witches now to steal her strength. She lifted herself up onto her hands and knees and made for Yedan. As she drew up alongside, she saw the hand nearer her move. Pulled herself up, knelt at his side, looked down into his face, the only part of him that had not been chewed and crushed beyond recognition. She saw his lips moving, leaned close.
"Beloved brother," she whispered, "it is Jan." "I see it,"
he whispered.
"What do you see?"
"I see it, Jan. It's there, right before me."
His broken lips smiled.
"Jadan?" "At last," he sighed. "I am home."
Their queen and the body of their prince, they were now an island upon the sea, and the last of them gathered round to hold its ever-shrinking shoreline. And above it all, three black dragons warred with 10 white dragons, and then there were only 2 against 10. Surrounding the island and its shore, the Leosan pushed in on waves of steel and fury. Theirs was the hunger of the ocean, and that was a hunger without end. But the ground trembled, it shivered, and the source of that steady drumming thunder was coming ever closer. Leaning like a drunk on the dais, Nemanda struggled for a way through this. It would seem that he had to veer, and soon, and then he would have to somehow resist Silana's will. He would have to fight her, try to kill her. But he knew he would fail. She would send his own kin against him, and the horror of the blood that would then spill was too much to bear. Sandalath Drukorlat still sat on the throne, muttering under her breath. "I could kill her. After all, do I not already have Tist Andi blood on my hands? And then, should we by some miracle prevail here, why, a usurper could take this throne. That too has been done before. And the new kingdom of Carcanus shall be born in the ashes of murder. Yes, I could do that. But look upon her, Nemanda. She does not even remember you. In her madness, I am my father. Sandalath, do you truly not remember? Withal and I, we lied to you. A terrible accident, the suicide that never was. Shall I lie to you again? No, I cannot." There were ghosts in this palace, in this very room. He had never before felt such palpable presence, as if countless ages had awakened to this moment, as if all of the fallen had returned to witness the end of every dream.
"Apsalara," he whispered, "I need you."
Came an answering whisper,
"It's not her you need."
Smiling down on the broken form of Anamanda Rick, Sandalath slowly drew her dagger.
"But he doesn't have the sword. He hasn't done what he vowed to do. How can I kill him now? Look at him, though. This thing. Against mighty Draconis? Impossible. I suspected it back on the island. That broken window, the body lying on the cobbles. How few his followers then, how pathetic his lack of control."
A new voice spoke.
"Orphantal will die if you do not release Silana."
Sandalath looked up, her eyes widened. A ghost stood before her, where Anamanda, in that bold, deceitful moment of bluster, had been a moment earlier. A woman, young, and she knew her.
"No, I do not. I will not. I refuse. How can my thoughts summon? Silana? Who was speaking of her? Was it me?"
To the ghost standing before her, she growled,
"I do not know you."
Smiling, the ghost said,
"But you do. You knew me all too well, as I recall. I am Fayed, my brother."
And she gestured down to Anamanda.
"Is of such honor that he would rather give you your end here and now than hurt you further. Nor will he threaten you with what he cannot do in any case, no matter what the cost, to his people, to those doomed humans upon the first shore."
"I only want my son,"
Sandalath whispered.
"He took him, and I want him back."
"This is not Anamanda Rake,"
Fayed said.
This is his son. How can you not remember Sandalath Drukorlat? Upon the islands, across the vast seas, you took us in as if we were your children. Now Nimanda is here, begging you to release Silana, to end the destruction of Karkanas.
Sandalath sneered. I can taste lies. They fill this room. 10,000 lies built this keep, stone by stone. Remember what Galan said? At the roots of every great empire you will find 10,000 lies. But he was not blind then, was he? I never trusted you, Fayard.
But you trusted Nimanda.
She blinked.
Nimanda?
You are right. He does not lie. What a damned fool. Just like his father, and see where it has got us.
Your son Orphantal will die, Sandalas Drukolat, unless you release Silana.
Orphantal, bring him to me.
I will, once you relinquish the throne and all the power it grants you. Once you free Silana from your will.
She licked her lips, studied the ghost's strangely flat eyes.
I remember those eyes, the knowing in them, knowing that I knew the truth of her, feared, venal, conscienceless.
You are the liar among us.
Feared cocked her head, smiled. I never liked you, it's true, but I never lied to you. Now, do you want to see your son or not? This is what I offer.
She stared at the ghost and then looked down at Anoman. No, Nimanda.
You have never lied to me, Nimanda. Does your sister speak true?
Do not ask him, Fayard snapped. This negotiation is between you and me. Sandalas, you of all people should understand what is going on here. You know the way of hostages.
Orphantal is not a hostage.
Events have changed things. There are new powers here.
That is not fair.
Fayard's laugh stabbed like a knife. The hostage whimpers at the unfairness of it all.
Don't.
Oh, shall I show some mercy then?
Stop it.
Very well, said Fayard. I will give you this gift. Retire to the chamber in the tower, Sandalath. You know the one. Lock the door from within so that no one else may enter. Remain there. Await your son. And when he comes, why, then you can unlock your door. To take him into your arms.
My room, my sweet, perfect room. If I wait there, if I hide there, everything will be all right.
Tears streamed down Sandalath's face.
Yes,
she whispered.
My son.
Will you yield the throne? Fayard asked. It must be now. Once you have done that, then you can go to your room, Sandalath. Where you will be safe, and where you can wait for him.
There was no end, it seemed, to what could spill down from her eyes. She rose, the dagger falling to clatter on the stones.
My room, yes. It's safe there. I have the lock there at the door, the lock to keep me safe. Silana, hear me. I will see my son. They will bring him to me. But first I must release you. Elaint, you are free. And soon we will all be free, all of us hostages. We will finally be free.
After Sandalas Drukorlat, making sounds like an excited child, had rushed from the throne room, Nimanda looked across at the ghost of Fayard, who stared back, expressionless.
I vowed to haunt you, my brother, my killer, to torment you for the rest of your days. Instead, you deliver me home.
His eyes narrowed on her, suspicious, as he knew he would always be with this one.
Join your kin, Nimanda. There is little time.
What of you? He demanded. Fayard seemed to soften before his eyes.
A mother will sit in a tower awaiting her son. She will keep the door locked. She will wait for the sound of boots upon the stairs. I go to keep her company.
Fayard, the ghost smiled.
Shall we call this penance, brother?
Blows rang, skittered off his armor, and beneath the banded ribbons of iron, the scales and the chain, his flesh was bruised, split, and crushed. Withal swung his mace, even as a spear point gouged a score above the rim of his helm, twisting his head round. He felt a shield shatter beneath his attacking blow, and someone cried out in pain. Half blinded, blood was now streaming down the inside of his helm, clouding the vision of his left eye. He pushed forward to finish the Leosan. Instead, he was shield-bashed from the side. Stumbling, tripping in a tangle of dead limbs, withal fell.
Now I'm in trouble.
A Leosan loomed over him, thrust down with his sword. A strange black flash blocking the blow, a blur, and the Leosan howled in agony, toppling back. Crouching now over withal, a half-naked woman, her muscles sheathed in sweat, an obsidian knife in one hand, dripping blood. She leaned close, her face pressing against the visor's bars.
Thief? What? What? My armor! You stole it! I didn't know. But you stood long, and there's more standing ahead, so get off your ass!
She grasped him by the collar of his hauberk, and with one hand pulled him to his feet, withal staggered for balance, brought his shield round and readied the mace. They were surrounded, fighting to the last. Overhead, two black dragons.
Where in Hood's name did they come from?
Were at the center of a storm of white and gold-hued dragons. They were torn, shredded, hissing like gutted cats, lashing out in fury even as they were being driven down and down. The half-naked woman fought beside him with serpentine grace, her ridiculous obsidian knives whispering out like black tongues, returning wet with blood. Confusion roared through Withall. This woman was a stranger, but that was impossible. Through the grill of his visor he shouted, "Who in Hood's name are you?" Charles sank back, knees folding, and suddenly she was lying on the ground. Figures crowded above her, twisted faces, thrusting spear shafts, feet fighting for purchase. She'd lost her sword and blood was welling from somewhere below her ribcage. Her fumbling fingers probed, found a puncture that went in and in.
Ah, I am slain.
Can you breathe? Take a breath, woman, a deep breath, and that's an order.
Captain?
You heard me.
Charles couldn't see her, somewhere behind her head, and her voice was barely recognizable, but who else would it be? Who else could it be? The ground trembled beneath her. Where was that trembling coming from? Like a thousand iron hearts, beating.
Beating.
She drew fetid air into her lungs, deeper and deeper still.
Captain, I can breathe.
Then you'll live. Get up. I want you with me. Till the end, you understand?
Charles tried to sit up, sank back in gasping pain.
Been stabbed, Captain.
That's how you get into this damned club. Stand up, damn you!
She rolled onto her side, easier this way to draw up her legs, to make her way to her hands and knees. Brevity was gasping out words.
Girl without a friend, nothing worse. Know what happens when a girl's got no friend?
No, Captain.
They get married!
Charles saw a sword nearby. A corpse was gripping it. She reached out and prized the weapon free.
All right, Captain, she said. I'll be your friend.
Till the end?
Till the end.
Swear it!
I swear! I swear!
A hand reached under an armpit, lifted her up.
Steady now, love. Let's go kill us some men!
Zevgan Drools had killed his debt holder, and then the bastard's whole family. Then he had burned down the estate, and with it all the records of the hundreds of families swindled into indebtedness by a man who thought he had the right to do whatever he damn well pleased, with as many lives as he could chain and shackle. Zevgan had gone on to burn down the bank, and then the Hall of Records. Well, only half of it, to be sure, but the right half. Not that anyone could prove a single thing, because he was no fool. Still, enough suspicions ended up crowding his feet, enough to get him sent to the prison islands, where he'd spent the last 21 years of his life, until the Exodus, until the March, until this damned shore. Too old to fight in the ranks, he now knelt on the berm overlooking the first shore, alongside a dozen or so others in the children's guard. The lame, the ancient, the half-blind and the half-deaf. Behind them, huddled in the gloom of the forest edge, all the young'uns and the pregnant women and those too old or, of late, too badly wounded to do any more fighting, and there were lots of those. Zevgan and his crew, and the 10 or so other squads, waited to give their lives defending the children of the Sheikh and the Lethary Islanders, the children and those others, but it was the children Zevgan kept thinking about. Well, it wouldn't be much of a defense, he knew. They all knew it, in fact. But that didn't matter.
Why should it? Those are children behind us, looking up to us with those scared eyes. What else counts?
Mixter Frill pushed up closer beside him, wiping at his nose.
So, you're confessing, are you?
You heard me, Zevgan replied. I did it, all of it. And I'd do it again, too. In fact, if they hadn't have stuck me on that island, I would never have stopped. I would have burned down all the banks, all the halls of records, all the fat estates with their fat lenders and their fat wives and husbands and fat whatevers.
You murdered innocents, Zev, is what you did. They should have hung you.
Hung, tortured, turned me inside out, roasted my balls and diced up my cock, aye, Mix. Errant knows, messing with how things are made up for the people in power. Why, there's no more heinous crime than that, and they'd be the first to tell you, too.
Look at them dying out there, Zev.
I'm looking, Mix.
And where next?
Where next, aye, and that's why I'm confessing. You see, it's my last laugh. At 'em all, right? Ain't strangled, ain't inside out, ain't ball roasted, ain't dick diced.
Mix said something, but with all the noise, Zev couldn't make it out. He twisted to ask, but then he saw on all sides figures rushing past. And there were swords and that raging forest behind them, with all that deafening noise that had been getting closer and closer, and now was here. Mix was shouting, but Zev just stared. Skin black as ink. Tall buggers, all manner of weapons out, hammering the rims of shields, and the look in their faces as they threaded through the camp where all the children huddled and stared, where the pregnant women flinched and shied, the look on their faces.
I know that look. I saw it in the mirror. I saw it in the mirror. The night I took 'em all down.
The two black dragons would not last much longer. It was a wonder they still lived, still fought on. Leaving them to his kin, Khadagar Phant descended to fly low over the shore. He could see the last of the hated enemy going down to the swords and spears of the elites. They were surrounded, those wretched murderers, stupidly protecting their leaders, the dead one and the woman kneeling at his side. Soon he would land. He would semble. Khadagar wanted to be there when that woman was the only one left. He wanted to cut her head off with his own hands. Was she the queen of all Karkanas? He believed she was. He had to acknowledge her bravery, to come down to the first shore to fight alongside her people. But not all bravery was worthy of reward, or even acknowledgement, and the only reward he intended for this woman was a quick death.
But a squalid one. Maybe I'll just choke the life from her.
This realm was thick with smoke, distant forests alight, and Khadagar wondered if the enemy sought to deny him the throne by perniciously burning the city to the ground. He could easily imagine such perfidy from this sort.
But I will rebuild, and I will loose the light upon this realm, scour away the darkness, the infernal shadows. Something new will be born of this, an age of peace, blessed peace.
He saw one of the black dragons spin past, pursued by two of his kin. That one, he knew, was moments from death.
Aparal, you should never have gone through first. You knew he would be waiting for you.
But his brother, his most loyal servant and friend, was now assembled, a lone, motionless body lying at the foot of Lightfall. From this height, pathetically small, insignificant, and this was improper, he would raise a monument to Aparal's sacrifice, to the glory of his slaying the wielder of the Hust sword. There, at the base of Lightfall itself, he would. Black as midnight, a tide was flooding out from the forest edge below. Khadagar stared in horror as it rushed across the strand and slammed into his Leosan legions.
"Tist Andi!"
He wheeled, crooked his wings, awakening the sorcery within him, and sped down towards his hated foes.
"I will kill them! I will kill them all!"
Something spun past him in a welter of blood and gore, one of his kin, torn to shreds. Khadagar screamed, twisted his neck, and glared upward. To see a red dragon, a true Elaint, twice the size of his kin, close upon a brother soul taken. Fire poured from it in a savage wave, struck the white dragon. The body exploded in a fireball, torn chunks of meat spinning away, trailing smoke. And now more black dragons sailed down from the sky. He saw two descend on the kin that had been pursuing the lone dragon, saw them crash down on them in a deluge of fangs and claws. The lone hunter below them banked then, and, wings thundering the air, rose towards Khadagar. Against him she would not last. Too wounded, too weakened, he would destroy her quickly and then return to aid his kin.
"This cannot end this way. It must not!"
Like a fist of stone, something hammered down on him. He shrieked in agony and rage as enormous talons tore ragged furrows deep across his back. Jaws snapped down, crushed one of his wings. Helpless, Khadagar plunged earthward. He struck the strand in a shower of crushed white bone, skidding and then rolling, slamming up against the unyielding wall of Lightfall. The sand pelted down, filling his ragged wounds. Far overhead, the death cries of his kin. 1,000 paces away, the battle at the breach. He was alone, hurt, broken. Khadagar assembled, dragged himself into a sitting position, setting his back to Lightfall, and watched the black dragon that had been rising to meet him now landing 30 paces away, shedding blood like rain. High overhead, the red Elaint killed another of his soul-taken kin, taking hold of it like a small bird, ripping its limbs off, crushing its skull in its massive jaws. Before him she had assembled, and now she walked towards him. Khadagar closed his eyes.
"My people, my people."
The sound of her boots. He looked up. She had a knife in one hand.
"My people," he said.
She showed him a red smile.
"Your people."
He stared up at her.
"Give me your name, Leosan."
"I am Khadagar Phant, Lord of Light."
"Lord of Light.
I call upon the ancient custom of hostage."
"We have no need of hostages. Your army is destroyed, Lord."
"I will speak for the Leosan. There shall be peace."
The woman nodded.
"Yes, there shall be peace. Lord Khadagar Phant, on behalf of the Tist Andi, welcome to darkness."
The knife flashed up towards his eye, a sudden sting of pain, and then... Khorlat stared down at the dead man, at her knife, pushed to the hilt in his right eye socket, and then she stepped back, turned away. At the breach, her Tist Andi kin were slaughtering the last of the Leosan. They had driven them back to the wound itself, and when the enemy retreated into the miasma, she saw ranks of Andi follow. There would be an end to this.
An end.
Overhead, Nimanda and his kin were descending, along with Prazek. Dathanar had fallen earlier. Khorlat had felt her death cry, and its howl still echoed in her soul. Silana remained high overhead, wheeling like a huntress. Not one of the Leosan soul-taken remained. She looked down the strand, eyes narrowing at the motley remnants of the Sheik, 300, 400 at the most, now hunched over, slumping, some falling in a ragged circle surrounding a kneeling figure. Her gaze drifted momentarily from this company of survivors, travelled over the solid carpet of bodies spreading out on all sides, and slowly the magnitude of the slaughter here upon the first shore found resolution.
Gods below.
She set out for those survivors, a woman dripping blood from too many wounds to count, and beneath her feet, in a steady drizzle, crimson rain. Impossibly, the sound was gone, and the silence now surrounding them had thickened. Withal knelt, bent over, struggling to find his breath, but some blow had broken ribs, and he was afraid to move, afraid to inhale too deeply. The half-naked woman settled down beside him, tortured him by leaning against him.
Now that was a fight, thief, and for you, maybe not over.
He was having trouble with his eyes. The blood was drying, seeking to close them up.
Not over? If you don't give that armor back, I will have to kill you.
He reached up, dragged his helm free, and let it tumble from his hands.
It's yours. I never want to see it again.
Ill words, she chided. It saved your life a dozen times this day. She was right in that. Still,
I don't care. Look up, man. It's the least you can do.
But that was too hard.
No. You did not see them here from the beginning. You did not see them die. How long have they been fighting? Weeks? Months? Forever?
I can see the truth of that.
They weren't soldiers.
I beg to differ.
They weren't soldiers!
Look up, old man. In the name of the fallen, look up! And so he did. He and the Sheikh, the Lethary, the Queen Yan Tobis, Twilight, these few hundred were surrounded once more. But this time, those facing them were Tist Andi, in their thousands, and not one was standing. Instead, they knelt, heads bowed, with all twisted round, made to rise.
I'm not the one needs to see this.
But the woman beside him caught his arm, forcibly pulled him back down.
No,
she said, like him looking across to Yan Tobis, who still knelt over the body of her brother, and who still held shut her eyes, as if she could hold back all the truths before her.
Not yet.
He saw Sergeant Sellows sitting near the Queen, the husked sword balanced across his thighs. He too seemed unable to look up, to see anything beyond his inner grief. And all the others, blind to all that surrounded them.
Oh, will not one of you look up? Look up and see those who have witnessed all that you have done? See how they honor you? But no, they are past such things now. Past them.
A group of Tist Andi approached from up the strand, something familiar there. Withal's eyes narrowed, and then he hissed a curse and climbed to his feet. Nimanda, Skintik, Desra, Nananda. But these were not the frail creatures he had once known.
If they ever were what I thought they were, if it was all hidden away back then, it is hidden no more. But Aranatha? Kedavis?
Withal, said Nimanda, his voice hoarse, almost broken.
You found your people,
Withal said, the head cocked.
And you yours.
But that notion hurt him deep inside, and he would not consider it. Shaking his head, he said,
The Sheikh and the Lethary Islanders, Nimanda, see what they have done.
They held the first shore.
And Withal now understood that hoarseness, all the broken edges of Nimanda's voice. Tears were streaming down his cheeks. For all that he had seen, that he must have seen, for surely he numbered among the black dragons of this strand, this battle. Nimanda turned as another Tist Andi staggered close, a woman half her clothes torn away, her flesh flensed and gashed.
Korlat, she did what was needed. She saw reason. Will you go to your mother now?
I will not.
Withal saw Nimanda's sudden frown.
She sits upon the throne of Karkana's Korlat. She must be made to know that her daughter has returned to her.
Korlat's eyes shifted slowly, fixed upon the kneeling form of Yan Tobis.
Her son was the only child that ever mattered to my mother, Nimanda, and I failed to protect him. She set that one charge upon me, to protect her son.
But you are her daughter, Korlat raised her voice.
Twilight, Queen of the Sheik, look upon me.
Slowly, Yan Tobis lifted her gaze. Korlat spoke.
I have no place in the palace of my mother, the Queen of Karkanas. In ancient times, Highness, there stood at your side a sister of night. Will you take me? Will you take Korlat, daughter of Sandalas Drukorlat?
Yan Tobis frowned. Her gaze wandered from the Tist Andi woman standing before her, wandered out to the kneeling Tist Andi, and then, at last, to the huddle of her own people, her so few survivors. And then, as if borne by an impossible strength, she climbed to her feet, brushed feebly at the sand clinging to her bloody clothes, straightened.
Korlat, daughter of Sandalas Drukorlat, the sister of night in the house of the Sheik is not for one of the pure blood. Forgive me, queen, but my blood is not pure.
Yan Tobis paused and then continued.
The blood of the Alaint, queen, my blood is not pure.
Withal suddenly comprehended Korlat's meaning. Cold dread curled in his chest.
No, Korlat will have no place in the palace of Queen Sandalas Drukorlat.
And how was it, after all that had happened here on the first shore, that his heart could still break one more time?
Oh, sand.
Yan Tobis spoke.
Korlat, daughter of Sandalas Drukorlat, I welcome you into the house of the Sheik. Sister of night, come to me.
One more time.
What are you doing?
Charles asked. She was lying down on the ground again, with no memory of how she'd got there.
Plug in the hole in your gut,
Brevity said.
Am I going to die?
Not a chance. You're my new best friend, remember? Speaking of which, what's your name?
Charles tried to lift herself up, but there was no strength left in her. She had never felt so weak. All she wanted to do was close her eyes and sleep. Someone was shaking her.
Don't! Don't you leave me alone!
Her body felt chained down, and she wanted free of it.
I never knew how to fight.
No, I can't bear this. Don't you understand? I can't bear to see you die.
I'm sorry. I wasn't brave enough for any of this. My brothers, they died years ago, you see. It was only my stubbornness, my guilt. I couldn't let them go. I brought them with me. And those two boys I found, they didn't mind the new names I gave them. Orus, Cassel. I couldn't stop them dying. It was hunger, that's all. When you have no land, no way through, when they just step over you in the street. I did my best. We were not good enough. They said so, that look in their eyes, stepping over us. We just weren't good enough, not clever enough, not brave enough. Cassel was 4 when he died. We left him in the alley behind Skadans. I found a bit of sacking. I put it over his eyes. Orus asked why, and I said it was what they did at funerals. They did things to the body. But why? He asked. I said I didn't know. When Orus died a month later, I found another piece of cloth. I put it over his eyes. Another alley. Another funeral. They were so little.
Someone was crying. A sound of terrible, soul-crushing anguish. But she herself was done with that.
Let the chains fall away, and for my eyes, a cloth. It's what they do.
With the Sister of Cold Nights standing close, Yan Tobis sat once more beside the body of her brother. She looked down on his face, wondering what seemed so different about it now, wondering what details had now arrived here in death that made it seem so peaceful. And then she saw. The muscles of his jaw were no longer taut, bunched by that incessant clench. And suddenly he seemed young, younger than she'd ever seen him before.
Yedan Derek, you are beautiful.
From all sides, she now heard, there rose a keening sound. Her shake and her lethargy were now mourning for their fallen prince. She let the sound close round her like a shroud.
Welcome home, then, brother.
Chapter 20. We stood watching the bodies tumbling and rolling down the broad steps. Half the city was on fire, and out in the farm holdings, terrified slaves were dragging the diseased carcasses into enormous heaps, while lamplighters wearing scarves poured oil and set alight the mountains of putrid flesh, until the black columns marched like demons across the land. In the canals, the corpses were so thick, we saw a filthy boy eschew the bridge for a wild scramble, but he only made it halfway before falling in, and the last we saw of him was a small hand waving desperately at the sky before it went down. Most of the malformed and wizened babies had already been put to death, as much an act of mercy as any kind of misplaced shame, though there was plenty about which we rightly should be ashamed, and who would dare argue that? The animals were gone, the skies were empty of life, the waters were poisoned, and where paradise had once beckoned, now desolation ruled, and it was all by our own righteous will. The last pair of politicians fell with hands around each other's throat, trailed by frantic toadies and professional apologists looking for a way out, though none existed, and soon they too choked on their own shit. As for us, well, we leaned our blooded pikes against the plinths of the toppled monument facing those broad steps, sat down in the wreckage, and discussed the weather. Sadakar's account, the fall of Inderus. The sun had set. The boy, awake at last, tottered into the Kundril camp. He held his arms as if cradling something. He heard the woman's cries. It was impossible not to. And all the Kundril had gathered outside a tent, even as the rest of the army pushed itself upright like a beast more dead than alive, to begin another night of marching. He stood, listening. There was the smell of blood in the air. War leader Gaul could hear his wife's labor pains. The sound filled him with horror. Could there be anything crueler than this?
To deliver a child into this world. By the fall of Kul'tane, have we not shed enough tears? Do we not bear their scars as proof?
He sought to roll over in his furs, wanting none of this, but he could not move. As if his body had died this day, and he but crouched inside it.
Born to a dying mother, who gathers round her now? Shelamassa, the last of the surviving shoulder women. But there are no daughters, no sons with their wives. And there is not me, and with this child, this last child, for the first time I will not witness my wife giving birth.
A knife pressed against his cheek, Jastara's voice hissed in his ear.
If you do not go to her now, Gaul, I will kill you myself. I cannot. For the coward you are, I will kill you. Do you hear me, Gaul? I will make your screams drown out the world, even your wife's cries. Or do you forget? I am Semk. This whole night I will make it your eternal torment. You will beg for release, and I shall deny it.
Then do it, woman.
Does not the father kneel before the mother in the time of birth? Does he not bow to the strength he himself does not possess? Does he not look into the eyes of the woman he loves, only to see a power strange and terrible? How it does not even see him, how it looks past, or no, how it looks within? Does not a man need to be humbled? Tell me, Gaul, that you refuse to see that again, one final time in your life. Witness it!
He blinked up at her. The knife point had dug deep, now grazing the bone of his cheek. He felt the blood running down to drip from the line of his jaw, the rim of his ear.
The child is not mine, he whispered.
But it is, you fool. Can't you see that? It will be the last Kundril child, the last of the burned tears. You are war leader Gaul. It shall be born, and it shall look up into your face. How dare you deny it that?
His breath was coming in gasps.
Do I have this left in me? Can I find the strength she demands of me? I have lost so much, so much. This is our final night, Gaul. Be our war leader one last time. Be a husband, be a father.
A feeble, trembling hand fumbled with the furs covering him. He caught its movement, wondered at it.
My own? Yes.
Groaning, he struggled to sit up. The knife slipped away from his bloody cheek. He stared across at Jastara.
My son did well by you.
Her eyes went wide. The color left her face. She shrank back. Gaul pushed the furs away, reached for his weapon belt. Summoned by a mother's cries, Badal walked with her children. Sadik stumbled at her side. They were all closing in like an indrawn breath. The army was on the move. She had not believed these soldiers capable of rising yet again to face the wastes ahead. She did not understand the source of strength they had found, the hard will in their eyes. Nor did she understand the way they looked at her and Sadik, and at the other children of the snake.
As if we have been made holy. As if we have blessed them. When the truth is, it is they who have blessed us, because now we children will not have to die alone. We can die in the arms of men and women. Men and women who for that moment become our fathers, our mothers.
But here in the Kundril camp, a new child was about to come into the world. When she arrived, the clawed warriors surrounded the birth tent. She saw the corpse of a horse nearby and walked over to stand upon it. Her children saw and they faced her, for they knew what was coming. Looking down, she met Sadik's shining eyes and nodded. Badal awakened her voice.
There is a mother this night.
Warriors turned to her. They had no choice. She would make them listen, if only to give them the one thing that she had left.
Where it all began, so it ends. This is what I have, the only thing I ever had, words. There is a mother this night, in the desert of dreams, beneath stars burned blind, and soldiers must march where she leads them on the dead trail. By this truth we are all bound, past the bodies left in the ditch. She looks up where we fail, and the sky is without end. Follow her, for the time of our birth is a birth still to come. There is a mother this night who leads an army of children. What will you ask of her when dawn awakens? What will you demand of her that she would give if only she could? There is a mother in the night for a child lost in the dark.
Faces stared up at her, but she could make no sense of what she saw in them, and she could barely remember the words she had just spoken. But when she looked down at Sadik, he nodded to tell her that he had them, gathered like the toys in the sack dangling from one hand.
And when he is a man, he will write this down, all of this. And one night a stranger will find him, a poet, a singer of tales and a whisperer of songs. He will come in search of the fallen. Like a newborn child, he will come in search of the fallen. Sadik, you will not die here, not for many, many years. How do I know this? And the woman who sleeps in the other room, who has loved you all her life, who is she? I would see that if I could.
The mother's cries were softer now. A man appeared, walked through the silent crowd that parted from his path, strode into the tent. Moments later, the mother inside was weeping, a sound that filled the world, that made Badal's heart pound. And then a small, pitiful wail. Badal sensed someone standing near her. She turned to see the adjunct.
"Mother," Badal said, "you should be leading your children."
"Did you truly think I would miss this?" Sighing, Badal stepped down from the carcass of the horse, reached out and took the adjunct's hand. She flinched as if stung, stared down at Badal as if in shock.
"Don't do that," she said. "Mother, when will you let yourself feel?"
The adjunct backed away, and moments later she was gone, lost in the crowd. If it made a path for her, Badal couldn't see it.
"There is a mother this night," she whispered, "but to her the stars are blind."
Korik reached up and with one finger probed the line of his gums. When he withdrew the finger and looked down, he saw that it was smeared with blood. And that was a good joke. He was dying of thirst, just like all the others, but he'd been drinking his own blood for 2 days now. Wiping his finger clean on his thigh, he glanced over at the others. Smiles was going to outlast them all. Women were stronger in ways no man dared admit, but then they had to be. There was more blood running down the back of his nose. He could never quite manage to get his throat clear of it, no matter how many times he swallowed. "They had to be a house of horrors. I saw all I ever needed to see, better than any tutor's endless droning on about history, better than all the sages and prophets and agitators and rebels. Aye, those ones made fists and shook them, punching walls at the injustice of it all. But those walls, they were just the boxes they'd built for themselves, the boxes they lived in. They could never see past. And for most of them, that box was their whole world. They had no idea there was anything outside it. But the whores knew. Laughter for the moment, but take the stretch of years and it's all heartbreak. A woman gives up her body when she has nothing else left to give. She gives it up like a man his last copper. In a whore's eyes, you'll find everything that we do to each other. Everything." He'd killed a fellow bone hunter last night, a man trying to steal an empty cask. But he wasn't thinking about that, that damned face so twisted with need, or the sigh that left the man on that last breath. No, he was thinking about whores. "They could have schooled me in shame, but they didn't. And now, God's help me, I wish they had." Because then he would understand what it was that forced his comrades back to their feet, that gave them the strength to pick up their gear one more time, knees bending under that weight. "The Malazan soldier carries on his back all that's needed for war. Dasim's credo for campaigns. But what if there's no war? What if the enemy is inside you? And what if this burden doesn't belong to just you? What if it belongs to a whole damned world? What then?" He'd listened to that captain, Ruthen Gud, lying dry-skinned in the unbearable heat, shivering beneath the last blanket he still owned. He heard about the boy and the girl and the toys spilled out on the ground between them. They'd forgotten the word, toys. But even finding it again hadn't helped much, because they'd also forgotten how to play. "There's a secret few would guess. In a house of whores, the love for children is as close to sacred as a mortal can get. Too precious to mock, because every whore remembers the child she once was. Maybe they were sad memories, maybe they were bittersweet, but it was all before the last thing was given away. So they know, it's innocence that is sacred, nothing else." On holy days, priests used to incite mobs to stone whores. No one would go out. He remembered all the women hiding in their rooms, speaking only in whispers lest some sound escape past the shutters or out under the door. And he used to cower with them, terrified, and on those days he came to learn a hatred for priests, for temples, for all those hunters of the unworthy. "So, crippled god, fallen one, If I could kill you with my bare hands, I would.